gentlemen. Hello again and welcome back to Don't Worry About the Government. My name is Chris Novembrino. I am joined here this evening by a Mr. Sean Frieder. Some people know him as the Super Nintendo Chalmers of Super PAX. This is a known thing on the internet, I have been told. How are you, Sean Frieder?
Chris, it's been too long. I'm doing good. Miss being on the show. Miss being the Super Nintendo Chalmers of Super PAX. Good to be back.
No, dude, it's good to catch up with you. We had a little bit of pre-show banter that I had to cut short because we have a hard out, but we need to have more pre-show banter, and we probably just need to talk more often. We'll be good. Be good.
Agreed.
All right, so let's get into the state of play of American politics. Like, there's no, like, deep, robust slate here. I mean, we can kind of ping and pong around. You want to start on the Rittenhouse trial? You want to start there? Yeah, all right, cool. I feel like everyone knows the story of Kyle Rittenhouse, so there's no setup needed here. But I'll just kind of come in with this. I've been really struggling with this case kind of on two fronts. On one hand, by the letter of the law for some of these charges, it does seem like Kyle Rittenhouse is not guilty of those specific charges. At the same time, the moral clarity of the fact that this young man drove across state lines with a weapon with pretty much the express purpose of using the weapon to hurt people is not lost on me. And then we also have the judge, who I think is sort of like unbelievably, like unwaveringly biased, and right down to dismissing that one charge today that Rittenhouse almost certainly would have been found guilty of.
Yeah.
I mean, so I've been really struggling with sort of this quandary of like, it feels like the justice system to like, you don't want to over extrapolate, but like, it feels like the justice system is broken down here. And what is the right response for people when the justice system
I'm glad you went abstract with it, because my reactions to this are also kind of more abstract. I think there's a lot of good legal commentary and racial commentary on what this means for the immediate case, for the immediate outcomes of these things. But, you know, my reaction to this has been twofold. One, you know, focused on the judge, same as you. I think this was put best online. I saw a meme going around of find someone that loves you the same way that the judge loves Kyle Rittenhouse. It's really clear. I mean, there's been so many incidences at this point. The first or second of these that I heard, I was like, it's hard to tell. Judges' lives are complicated. But by the time you get to like the eighth, the ninth detail, you have like Lee Greenwood's God Bless America going off on his cell phone in the middle of the courtroom.
The one that got me, Sean, was the round of applause for Veterans Day thing.
Yes.
Which resulted in the witness for the defense getting a round of applause before taking the stand.
Remarkable. I mean, there's the miscarriage of justice stuff you're talking. I mean, like, it is really crazy. I don't know if you got a chance to see earlier this year on Netflix, I believe, the trial of the Chicago 7 when that came out. But the judge in that is like, Julius something. I can't remember the guy's name, but he is one of the better villains in recent movie history. And this judge reminds me just so much of him, of just like, I can't believe you're not even making any effort whatsoever to try and appear in the middle or to not potentially cause a mistrial or any number of things. So, I mean, my reaction to this has been, it's the same thing here in these legal trials as we're facing in politics, is like what we're ultimately lacking in this country is an absolute lack of trust. And the main people who would be instrumental in restoring that lack of trust, or at least finding some way to like make things, at least when they should be objective in a courtroom, to make them somewhat more objective, it just doesn't seem like there's really anyone right now capable of restoring that trust. I don't really know what to do about this long term. I mean, this is one of those moments where like part of me in the back of my mind is just like, we're cooked. Like, fuck it. We're doomed. Like, I don't see a way out of this. There is like, it is very, very easy to lose trust amongst the people. And we have so lost it that I just don't see it coming back. And like, it's particularly during these trials that I just kind of really get reminded of that.
Yeah, like these last 5 years, I mean, I think you can now kind of step back and really take like an assessment of how little confidence people have in so many different key institutions, whether it's the presidency, whether it's Trump, Or even now with Biden and like the prevalence of let's go Brandon, which we can talk about here too. But this idea, like screw the presidency. I mean, I'm so old. I remember when it was like, you never say anything bad about your commander in chief. And now we say, let's go Brandon. The justice system, same thing. People don't have trust in that. The schools, same thing. People are having issues with that. And I'm with you. Like, it's actually fairly easy to like launch an assault on trust in institutions, and it's much, much harder for institutions to build up institutional trust. Like it's absolutely so easy to tear this stuff down, but it's really, really hard for this stuff to get built back up, and then let alone built back better. And then you have a guy like this judge here who, I mean, it just makes it very clear, like, what he wants the outcome of the trial to be. And then lastly, let's not forget, the prosecution has done a very bad job during this case. I'm bringing up that witness for the prosecution, who basically gave Kyle Rittenhouse a plausible avenue towards self-defense, was absolute prosecutorial misconduct. And the only way I could sort of defend that is if the prosecutor knew that the defense was going to call up the witness. But it didn't seem like they did. So I really struggle with this because, like, I mean, he's going to get off, and then it's like one of two things is going to happen, both of which would be bad. One, the kid walks free and gets elevated to folk hero status among the right, starts appearing at political events and becomes a political, like, you know, little political player. Very, very likely outcome of this. And he's really embracing being a pariah. His mom is really embracing Sean Hannity. They like being political figures. Or worse still, someone takes the law into their own hands saying, I watched this trial. This trial failed. That guy's a murderer. And murderers get justice. Both of which
I would say... Yeah, I mean, like, I agree with that. I think an additional angle, too, is, and, you know, my point here is not that we should not be having a trial. A crime has been, you know, charged, and you have trials for that. So the end, I mean, obviously we have one. And obviously with this being, you know, connected to these events, this is going to receive an unbelievable amount of media attention when that trial does happen. So there's really no choice we could have made other than to walk down this exact path. But, you know, my reaction is also, if we kind of pull back from this, like, you know, compared to the George Floyd case, which, you know, similar amount of attention on the trial. And, you know, when the jury released their verdict, it was a really big deal. It was one of these like critical cases. That was at least, you know, that was a trial about the death of the person at the hands of the police officer. It feels like we're somehow moving backwards with this trial where, you know, the trial is at the similar level of stakes, but now we're even like one further step removed where we're not talking about the Jacob Blake case directly. We're not talking about the police misconduct. I mean, all that stuff, that's a different issue, but like so much of this energy is being invested in this like second or even third order thing related to this issue that's like the core issue we care about. And at some level, like, I just feel like we're putting an enormous amount of emotional energy into this one person. And I just really hope that even in the best case scenario, as you outline, in which like he gets justice, and we see some jail time.
I want to be clear, courtroom justice.
Courtroom justice. Yes, as we have to now say out loud these days, you know, he gets that. I don't know, really, you know, we put a lot of time, energy, emotions into this. It's not like anything politically has changed at all or gotten any better. And that's kind of just where I'm at this point. It's like, I feel kind of the same way about as we're going through and we're seeing all the trials and the sentencing for all of the people that were on January 6th breaking into the Capitol building. Same thing. It seems important. We have to do this. I'm totally on board with all these trials. People should receive justice. But at the end of the day, like, there's a lot of media time, a lot of media attention. And it still just makes me think, like, at the end of the day, is anything gotten any better? Have we made any headway whatsoever on the political issues of the day? It's just frustrating. It feels like we're like, I'm in a nightmare. And like, it's one of those weird nightmares where you're just like slowly drifting backwards, grasping at something, and you just can't quite grasp onto it. It just feels like things are slipping farther away in that sense.
Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. The Rittenhouse trial, I'm with you. It's important. Like, what he did was wrong. He should face justice for it and everything. But like, it the way the conservatives have sort of won on this is twofold. First, they've won by making him into a folk hero. And what really actually needs to be on trial, which isn't on trial, but like in a way the judge is actually putting his finger on the scale on this in a serious way, is Kyle Rittenhouse is not a folk hero. He's a murderer. You shouldn't like want your son to grow up to be like Kyle Rittenhouse. You shouldn't want your daughter to date Kyle Rittenhouse, or your son to date Kyle Rittenhouse. I'm being progressive here. Like, you should not want Kyle Rittenhouse to be part of your family here. This guy is a bad guy, and half the country has decided that he's just a mixed up kid who was just like in over his head. No, you know, it was just a crazy night. He was just, you know, living his life or whatever. And like, that legitimately should be on trial. And I think, like, I feel your vibe on the 1-6 trials, the people who participated in the domestic terror event on 1-6, because like, what isn't like on trial, or maybe needs to be on trial more forcibly, is the idea that these people are terrorists, and that what they did was, in the purest definitions of the word, terrorism. It was an action taken to affect a specific political outcome, and the salience and the tangibility of that belief is only becoming more apparent as time goes on. I mean, we hear about like all these different, like the Eastman memo, but then like the way, yeah, Trump was talking about it. I mean, like, people really believe that there was a national treasure button that you could hit with Nicolas Cage and you could open up the secret door where Trump gets reelected for a second term. And that's why they did what they did. And because they believe that, because we know what their mens rea was, this is terrorism. But it's not really being put on trial as terrorism. And the Democrats aren't really talking about once. The Democrats have found a way to talk about 1-6 where it's not a terror event. It was a bad day. It was very bad. It should never happen again, but it wasn't terrorism.
They won't use that word pointedly because, yeah, they think they're cultural losers on these issues. And I think at the very least, in the way that the Democratic Party presents its messaging, they are cultural losers on these issues a lot of the time. But they also don't have to be. They just need to get better at messaging. And this comes from, again, I mean, like, refreshing the leadership. That's, I think, pretty much the only way that you're going to get the messaging right in the first place. But I mean, you look at the other thing that bothers me about both the Rittenhouse and the 1-6 trials is the most important thing to me is the thing that I know for sure prosecutors are going to try and minimize as much as possible, which is that they feel as if they are not responsible for their own actions, that like they are really just following the directions of thought leaders, be that elected officials or people on Fox News or whatever. I mean, that is directly and literally the defense of most of the 1-6 people. And Rittenhouse, you know, like if you were to give that angle, it would just provide a little bit more of an alibi or cushion for him. So like, you know, the prosecutors are going to back off that angle. But as far as what I think of, when I think of the danger of what happened in Kenosha or what happened in Washington, D.C. on 1-6, I mean, I think of that there's a siren that goes off every once in a while that calls crazy people to go do crazy shit. And that's not, like, by definition, that's not what's on trial in these trials. And it just feels like what I'd really, you know, would restore some of my faith is like a larger moment of acknowledging, like, here's where we are and you all see it and you're trying to fix that. You're not just trying to put the bad guys in jail that did the temporary thing, because the next time the siren goes off, there'll just be 10 new bad guys and we can keep arresting them and keep having these trials. But like, this is at best solving the symptoms and probably not even then. And it's not solving the disease.
And when you say the siren, I mean, I think like that's like not a bad way of putting it, because it's a loud, physically like present existing object. And in this case, the siren is Fox News. The siren is One America News Network. The siren is Mike Cernovich and Steve Bannon. The siren is QAnon. And to your point, I think what is very frustrating is that like so many of these people who are, in my opinion, at least morally responsible for a lot of this stuff, like you can't have 1-6 in a vacuum. You need thought leaders. They don't face trial because of the way our laws are written. You know, so like even when it comes to the 1-6 stuff, we're going to try all the people who like actually stormed the Capitol or whatever, but like Josh Hawley isn't going to face any sort of consequence for this. You know, Donald Trump isn't going to face any sort of consequence for this. Even when it's in the Democrats' own best interest to actually like make Donald Trump face consequences from this so that he doesn't run again and have like the benefit of, oh, I was screwed out of this. I mean, I think, and I'm with you, I think what concerns me is that like, okay, I saw a poll recently that said that the number of Republicans who thought Trump legitimately won the election in 2020 has actually gone up. It's like close to 40% of Yeah.
It's still very high. I mean, like it bounces around 2 out of 5. You know, some polls it gets pretty close to the halfway mark that I've seen. But I think, yeah, 40% or so is probably about the right number on that. And yeah, I mean, I will say, even, you know, from my own perspective, you know, being in a classroom now and being in, you know, I was previously in Berkeley, which obviously, like, that's going to be blue as all get out.
A lot of conservatives there.
Yeah, Berkeley, well-known conservative bastion. You know, moving to Jacksonville, you know, it's in the South, but it's also a major metropolitan area. So Jacksonville's about as straight down the center purple as you can get. And, you know, it changes the way even I have to, you know, interface with my students, the way that I have to talk about certain things. There's all sorts of shit that I have to be very thoughtful about. How can I be convincing here as someone that studies this stuff that, like, I never had to think about that stuff before. And so things
like... Give me an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, like, mostly things like I could say, you know, in 2012, with no pushback, no one even blinking, that, you know, election fraud is just not a thing. It's, you know, it happens to some degree, but, you know, no one meaningfully thinks amongst the expert group here that it's a problem we're solving. And by trying to solve it, you're actually probably going to end up suppressing votes. So, you know, clearly, like, there's a set of things to do here and not do. I could say that, you know, I would imagine that I don't have the experience, but like here where I live, like a decade ago, and mostly people would just kind of nod their heads. It would be one of those things that's like, this is good to know. I'm learning about my electoral system. Now, when I say that shit, I feel like it sounds to my students like I'm taking a stand. And I actually have to like preface that with, this is not a hot take because I don't do that in the classroom. Like, I think, like, especially that's one of the things I have to think through right now. I'm not, like, you know, saying what I think on most issues in the classroom, because I think with the lack of trust that there is these days, especially perhaps amongst young people, the moment I show my cards which team I'm on, it's fucking over for half the room. So I just don't do it. And this is one of those moments where, like, I have to say this when it comes to election fraud. I mean, this is a big issue. This is what I study. And I have to put my foot down on, like, there's one side to this issue. But, you know, I can feel that the moment that happens, it's a little murkier now. And there's some people that, you know, I'll get emails every once in a while after I bring something like that up, where, like, they'll be wondering, but what about this? What about that? It's not overwhelming. I haven't, you know, been contacted by a lot of people that are like, you're a liar and I'm going to sue you, or like nothing like that's happened. But like, it's just as the trust decreases in the country, it becomes increasingly difficult to sound like you're an expert without sounding like you're a biased expert. And like, that sucks. That really, really concerns me.
Man, that gets me into another thing. The constant war on expertise over the last 5-6 years.
Oh, man.
Dude, I mean, there are a few things that drive me further up a wall than the right side.
I would put it above polarization in terms of things that worry me. I mean, like, the decline of trust in experts, that might be number one for me. I mean, climate change is long-term disaster, but
climate change is sort of like impossible.
Exactly. Like, we don't solve these problems if, like, you don't believe the experts. And I will say, at least, you know, with climate change, I'm seeing Democrats, Republicans under the age of 30, like, they want to take action. It's a different kind of narrative. But, you know, other forms of expertise, election expertise, you know, expertise on, you know, what's likely to happen in terms of Congress votes. Just within my field, I see, you know, more pushback than I've ever seen. Not to mention, I mean, Jesus Christ, the last year and a half has just been like public health experts just fighting a losing battle constantly. And it's very frustrating to see that happen. I talk to other professors in different departments. And I mean, it's the same thing in every department. Whatever that thing is that could attach itself to politics, where there's a little element of trust involved, now it's a grenade. And you just have grenades in the class.
The experts thing. I mean, it troubles me deeply because it's like, look, I get it. Can you go on YouTube and learn how to play guitar? Sort of. Yeah, I guess. But like, is it better than like actually having an expert musician teach you like guitar? No, it's obviously not. Like, yeah. Can you go on YouTube and figure out how to fix what's going on with your Ford Fiesta? Yeah, probably. You should probably go to the mechanic though and have them do that, probably. We increasingly, especially what troubles me the most, dude, is there is this thing about politics. It's like this like electric fence or something. Like, the second you touch it, you'll be talking with a normal person, And the second it moves to anything even adjacent of politicism, I guess I attributed this to you years ago, but then you're like, I don't, this is not my thesis. But the people as heuristics thing, I increasingly am convinced that like this really is all there is. And it's not, and what's even worse is it's not even experts as heuristics. It's literally now just like the voice I trust. It's, I trust my priest. Ipso facto, when my priest gives me information on biology or science, I guess I'm going to listen to them now on that. I like Tucker Carlson when he talks about the news. Ipso facto, he's having Robert F. Kennedy on to talk about vaccine truth.
Oh, God.
I guess I'm going to have to listen to him on this. I increasingly am convinced of it. And you see this with resistant Democrat Twitter, too, where it's like they just like take what Nancy Pelosi and Maddow and stuff are saying sort of like unwaveringly. I'm very convinced that the driving force of our political times right now is we have our voices that we trust. And I mean, I guess I even fall into that. But hopefully, if you're listening to me and you trust me, you also know better to do your own fucking research. And like, that's why I say things like that. But like, we have these voices that we trust, and they take primacy over like people who we should actually recognize as like real experts. Like, I don't know shit all about Fauci's like biography, but like, he's probably there for a reason. He probably is.
I mean, this is the guy, I mean, as an epidemiologist, like, I mean, he was instrumental in creating, like, you know, some of the stuff that helped reduce, like, the trauma and severity of AIDS. I mean, he's been recognized in his field. Like, again, like, he's the Babe Ruth of his field. There's not even a question. And that's the problem, is that, like, I think that, as you're saying, I'm not going to own the people are heuristics hypothesis, but I'd sign on to it completely. I do think that's basically all there is at this point. We cue off of social trust. Trust can be created in a variety of ways. One of the ways that trust can be created is through institutions. And I think that is what we've been reliant on for a really long time in society, is this idea that if you rise to a certain level in health, in tech, in finance, in media journalism, et cetera, it's a genuine signal that you can be trusted. And like, people don't have that signal anymore for bad reasons, but also for good reasons, because there's a lot of people that have been involved in like that hierarchy that have done a lot to dilute the trust of people. I mean,
oh, you like, you shouldn't trust Elon Musk. Like look at Elon Musk.
Right,
he's a really powerful dude who on a routine basis explains to you like in agonizing detail why you shouldn't trust him, if only you'll listen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like you take people that rise to the top of their, and like now they are, I don't think, like, I get the sense when I'm talking that what I'm saying is taken at the same level of I'm an expert in trustability as a person running for office, which is terrifying, because the experts about the system are very different than the people that are actually in the system. And like, you know, you should not listen to me at all on some things. You should talk to them. You should listen to me on some things and not at all to them, because, you know, that's going to be lying and propaganda, et cetera. But I don't think that people are drawing those lines as cleanly anymore. And in the medical profession, I don't think when people think of nurses and doctors, they're thinking of it in this institutional sort of sense where you should generally trust this type of person. I think they're thinking of, well, what about the FDA, which I know has been corrupted in all these ways in the past? And what about, like, you know, like big pharmaceutical companies that are fucking us over? I mean, there's documentaries right now being produced, like on Amazon, I think they have Dope Sick, right? That the TV series about the
fentanyl.
The pharma family, with them, you know, that you have that documentary going right now. And I think, again, when people think of medical experts, are they thinking about that family, you know, that produces this drug? Are they thinking about actual medical experts?
The Sacklers.
Thank you. Yes. You know, like, what are people thinking of when they think of experts? And I think increasingly, like, the leveraging power of experts has been purchased out from under them by these other figures that, to the average person, they don't look distinct from experts. I mean, experts know you're not even of my tribe. Like, fuck off. But the average person just sees them as like another talking head saying shit. And there's certain talking heads that you have good reason to trust and ones you really, really don't.
And worse still, because people don't know what an expert is. So often we determine expertise based on like charisma. Like, and that's like the most dangerous thing is you can have
absolutely
a really expert person, but you could have someone who's not an expert kind of rebutting them, who is charismatic as shit, and they can make that expert like basically be ineffectual because people don't care about their expertise because they're so compelled by the bombastic rebuttal.
Absolutely, man. I mean, yeah, you anticipated like exactly the next thing I was going to say, because like I was going to, you know, like one way that we've historically built trust is through institutions. That's gone now in many ways. What are the remaining ways that we build trust? Well, we build trust interpersonally, but you know, that's not going to help us too much when it comes to experts, because you're not going to have an interpersonal relationship with your expert, but you do get an opportunity to have an interpersonal relationship with your buddy, Steve. You have an opportunity to have an interpersonal relationship with some random asshole that you see on YouTube that reflects your own, like, you know, secondary opinions back at yourself. You can build up trust with people that basically are charismatic. And I mean, like, the version of this that we see in voting is we see that there's a real effect that, you know, when people see someone as more attractive or more competent, they're, it's not going to like swing a ton of elections, but they're somewhat more likely to vote for that person. Same thing here. You're somewhat more likely to, significantly more likely to trust someone if they're just charismatic. And like, nope, charismatic is the province of sociopaths. I mean, I would like to think I have some charisma, but like, that's a thing to be nervous about. When you're,
it's
when,
one thing to have charisma, but it's another thing to be one of these people who radiates it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I can have, I mean, I host a radio show. I can have moments where I'm fucking charismatic or whatever, but it's not the same thing as these people who like, I guess Beto work it up and go and stand on a table and like actually like yen for that.
Well, you invoked Beto O'Rourke. Maybe we should should we talk about the midterms?
Is he going to show up in my house if I say his name three times? Shit. All
right. Watch out. You've already said it twice. So
yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the midterms here. So Dems are cruising into the midterms right now. Things don't look great for them. There's a recent round of polling that said the elections were today or like yesterday or whatever. They would have gotten their asses handed to them. I'm going to just toss out my theory as to why this is and feel free to rebut it. I think this is because for the last 11 months, Joe Biden has gotten into office and has been kind of running on an autopilot sort of way. He got in and right off the bat, they went balls to the wall on the Georgia election. They promised $2,000. They delivered $1,400. Not great, but better than nothing. Probably helped them on the margins, but it's one of those things that put people on the edge. Then after that $1,400 moment, there's basically been nothing. Through April, May, June, the administration errantly declared mission accomplished over COVID-19, only to be set back really, really badly and be really embarrassed by July 4th. I have to imagine that hurt them. And then this whole way down, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema have been running circles around the progressives. But let's go ahead and give Joe Biden and Pelosi credit and assume that they actually want Build Back Better to pass here. Also Joe Biden as well. So like you brought up competency here. I think one of the big things that's hurting Joe Biden and by reflection Kamala Harris is a real lack of a sense of competency. That it seems like that they are not very competent on the legislative side. To that point, okay, they passed BIF. People are not really excited about BIF other than a Democratic partisan who's yelling at you that you should love it. But even in the passage of BIF, it doesn't really feel like Joe Biden did a whole lot to get that across the finish line. So at no point over the last 11 months here has there really been anything for Biden and his team and Harris and her team to latch onto to show competent, strong leadership. It's not even just that they don't have stuff to run on, although let's be honest, if they actually finally came around on marijuana legalization, that'd probably help them.
Biden would be the last person of all of the 23 candidates on that stage 2 years ago to do it, which, I mean, what a shame. I mean, there's a slam dunk. That's three free points to anyone that just wants to throw that one through the hoop. That's an easy one.
I mean, and the worst part is, like, if you want to talk about how do the Democrats lose an election that they have absolutely no business losing in 2024, they choose not to adopt marijuana legalization. Republicans get some internal polling that says, you know what? We can just say, send it back to the states like we just did with Roe versus Wade, and we'll will sound like we're legalizing it. And the Democrats are going to spend the rest of the campaign going like, how are we losing on weed? They don't even like weed. Like, yeah, no, like, yeah. I mean, so that's my takeaway for why I think the Democrats are going to be hurting here in the midterms. I didn't think this was a foregone conclusion. I talked about for months how, like, I thought that actually the Republicans have been shooting themselves in the foot over and over on COVID, but the Democrats have just never found a way to take advantage of it, and they've just been getting their asses handed to them when it comes to the congressional side.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot. I mean, I think there's absolutely just like a ton of shit going on here, and, you know, I will start by just saying that the baseline of expectations that we should be operating off of, and this was true, we should have been operating off these baseline expectations a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it doesn't really matter, but, you know, you follow a party that just won the White House into the midterm election 2 years later and doesn't go well. The only time that it's ever gone well for that party was 2002, and that was just basically an artifact of 9/11. So
you need exceptional cases. So that was the only thing that the Dems had going for them.
That's it.
COVID could serve as that exceptional case.
Maybe COVID's an exceptional case. You know, the thing I was maybe holding out for a little while for 2022 was that all of this talk about elections are all bullshit and fraud. Maybe you get some depressed Republican turnout. That definitely does not seem to be the case based on what we saw this year. Hard to say in the future.
And one last thing, the Democrats could have taken 1/6 and used it as an opportunity to paint the Republicans as absolutely radical, that this is a party that we can't work with. They need to reform themselves right now, and we need to steamroll past them, and we need to govern while the Republicans are in the wilderness and figuring things out. And Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema with their constant chorus of, we need to work with these very reasonable Republicans across the aisle, have gone a very long way to actually take a key campaigning tool away from the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I think that going back to both that and what you're saying about the competence level of Harris and Biden, you know, I think that we have to really start kind of from what did we purchase for ourselves in the 2020 election? And I think it was obvious to me then, and it's been obvious since, that this was a triage election for Democrats. Like, this was them just shoving everything against the door that they could find that wouldn't walk away so that Trump couldn't get back into the White House. And that was really the only thing that they were trying to figure out how to do. How do you get into the White House? You screw Bernie Sanders, you endorse Biden, you engineer an entire campaign where moderate and older Democrats are going to go out and vote for a Biden that they can believe in. You don't do anything crazy. You throw the youth, I guess, the left, I guess, a bone with Kamala Harris, which is a terrible bone to throw because the left does not like her.
Yeah, if she's a bone, I would expect to see this in the polls at some point in her lifetime.
Yes.
Like any point in her lifetime.
No, like bad. So I mean, you have two people that I think are chosen on the basis of the party believes this is what they need to defeat Trump. You know, who knows, like if we rerun this with a Sanders-Warren presidency, do they win? Do they lose? I can't say for sure. I have my ideas on that, but whatever. Like we nevertheless now end up with a very, very old president that has never been much for speechcraft and is not, I would say, anything other than kind of an uninspiring workhorse. I mean, he's not Trump. He's kind. He seems like a decent human being. Those are all advantages. But at the end of the day, the average person, like if you're going to have a chance in that midterm election, that your party is always going to almost certainly lose. If you want to even give yourself a fighting chance there, you have to have a figure. Now, I mean, I might have problems with different aspects of how Obama strategically handled his presidency, but you've got a figure there. And I might think that Trump is the devil, but you have a figure there. Biden, Harris, these are not figures. This is not the future of the party. There's no moving forward from this. And at the end of the day, there's going to be a sense from people that there's just not able leadership at the top. And you see this when, I mean, obviously Biden is not very, very involved in the negotiations in the Senate. And even if, and I think it'd be a reasonable thing to say as a Democratic strategist, like maybe you look at it and you say, it's just Manchin and Sinema versus the rest of the world. Maybe there's really not much that the president could do to jump in there. But like half the game at that point then is just looking as if you're jumping in. I mean, I totally was fine with during the 2020 election campaign, the Biden in a bunker thing. You can't have Biden in a bunker as the president. He has to be out there as the main face of the Democratic Party. And like there has probably not been someone since Jimmy Carter that has so little had the ability to become that face of the party. And so what do you
and
do?
Jimmy
when you
was
try
actually
and,
better at that than Biden.
He was better. He was better. Yeah. I mean, what do you try and do to put a face on a party that really at the end of the day, what they're trying to hide is that the face doesn't really exist. If Biden's the face, you lose the young and the left. If Harris, or God forbid to them, Sanders is the face, you lose the old and the moderate. So
the argument is the Electoral College becomes very hard to win with the progressive because of the
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's just worth acknowledging, like, sometimes problems don't have great solutions, and the Democrats are just in kind of a pickle in terms of, like, they have two bases which can be satisfied by some of the same issues, but are really opposed on the opposite issues. And the Republicans, it's not like they don't have this. It just seems like the Republicans are so much more easily motivated by just get Trump back into office. That's pretty much it. And they're able to unite around that. And I just think it's a difficult thing for any party in governance. I mean, Trump faced this when he was president. He didn't have an easy time of it. It's hard to govern, and it's harder to govern still under polarization. But I think that the difference between Trump and Biden is that there's a public perception that Trump is driving things, whereas the public perception is that Biden is following everyone else. And that could be 20 different groups of people. When it feels like chaos in your everyday regular life, even if there was more chaos under a Trump White House, you don't want to have to fill in the gaps yourself. Is like, what is the president doing today to make things better? And I think that's what a lot of people are doing. It's just like, I don't know. I don't know if he's doing anything.
Yeah. I mean, I've had exchanges with people who've been on the show here about the BIF, like the people who are excited about it. And I was like, what do you like about it? They sent me some like top line notes. I'm like, no, like, what do you like about it? Like, what is so great about it to you? Like, okay. Yeah. It's, I'm a Democratic voter. I want the Democrats to get legislative victories and not lose. Okay. Sure. Yeah. Duh. But like, what do I like about it? Like, at the end of the day, what do I like about it? And there's nothing. There's nothing. If anything, it leaves me kind of cold because it means more toll roads. And I'm like, literally, like, looking at my front door at a massive toll road expansion right now. I fucking hate toll roads. And so, like, when I heard that this was going to be about toll roads, like, he could. I mean, other than his stances on marijuana, which Biden has been very agonizingly consistent on, there are a few things that he has that are like worst takes. Okay, I know we're a little tight on time, but can we do Kamala for like a few minutes?
Yeah, please. I mean, I got a text. I got about an extra 10, 15 minutes, so I can go till 10. Let's just keep it. Let's keep it rolling.
Dope. Okay. So
really quick. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
On the point that you're making with Biden, with Harris, with, you know, like the trust that they have with the voters, with the Build Back Better versus the building infrastructure, like the BIF versus the BBB. Here's the thing with the BIF is this is an old school Democrats way of thinking about how to win elections. Infrastructure is great. And like the infrastructure that's there, the toll roads, fair point. I also hate toll roads, so I'm with you on that one, buddy. But in terms of like what's going to make people actually, I think this is your line back in the day, put on their pants and go vote. Infrastructure is like the bread that a restaurant brings out to you at the beginning of the meal. It's kind of expected. It's a little bit filling, but like there's not a lot there that's actually, it's not why you went to the restaurant. It's not really making anyone happy. That's the thing, is that the BBB contains the stuff that actually would make a decent portion of the base happy. And I mean, half of that stuff has now been ratcheted out, but you've got stuff there that is going to feel like, to the average person, like no one is saying, other than maybe someone that's like a really deep old school union 60, 70 year old Democrat or something, no one's going to say like, this is why I voted Biden in, is to get this infrastructure. The primary problem of the last 6 years in politics has been our roads are falling apart. Like no one thinks this. It's obvious that no one thinks this. And the idea that you're going to get credit for big bills that people don't really understand or care about, like we're fighting 15 culture wars simultaneously.
No, if anything, there has been a sustaining narrative war against big bills that we don't really understand by the Republicans.
Right.
Quite successfully, where they're like, what's in it? We don't even know what's in it. We don't know. And that's a fair point about BIF. There's a lot of stuff in BIF that people don't know about. To your point, Build Back Better, I think, like, man, if Biden had actually, what if they'd never decoupled them? We should talk about that in a second. But like, yeah. I mean, if they had passed Build Back Better, I think this is a completely different conversation where you and I are like going like, look, there are other things, like especially if they had passed $3.5 billion Build Back Better.
Oh, hell. I mean, like, as many criticisms as I might throw out there for the DNC and the Biden administration and just like Democratic leadership in general, if they had somehow managed to pass Triple B, I would be saying like, here's an administration that has somehow, I don't know if I give the credit to Biden or Schumer or Pelosi or
no, they finally figured it out. You run as a centrist and you govern as a liberal. Duh.
Like, yeah, and they like, and that would be them doing it. But no, you run as a centrist and then you let them call you a communist and then you govern as less than a centrist. I mean, it's very frustrating. And so you're going to have the same problem. You're going to have depressed Democratic turnout. You're going to have the left that says thanks for nothing. And you're going to try and like, I mean, I'm going to watch the Democrats trying to say, but what about Biff? And they're not going to react to it. They don't care. It doesn't mean anything to people. It's like, this is, we expect the trains to run on time. That's the basic low-level expectation of government. And infrastructure getting repaired is one of those things. Like the fact that, like, this is another thing that, like, the Trump administration, this was an easy $20 bill, like marijuana legalization, just pick it off the fucking ground and take credit for it. They didn't do that. So I guess the Biden administration is doing it here too. But no, like,
the funny part is that Trump could have done this, but he wanted to leverage it to get them to stop investigating him over Russia.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But like, at the same time, I guess an important point there is there was not a real penalty from the American people for not getting infrastructure passed. Like, no one cared about.
To see, like, in studying public opinion, you see much like the overwhelming theme of the field is no one knows anything's happening. Even if they do, no one knows what's in the things that are happening. And even if they do, no one really cares. And even if they do, by the time the election happens, everyone will have forgotten it. Here's what's going to happen at election time. Voters are going to say to themselves, all this shit, this negative, awful shit that I've been feeling terrible about for 2 years, is anything better than it was back in 2020 compared to 2022? Those things that I personally care about, the things that I think about daily life, you know, like racism in society, has that gotten any better? Global warming, has that, you know, been fought at all? The world and leadership, is that getting any better? All these progressive wealth inequality proposals that I think is really the animating center of the party or what it should be, is any of that getting any better? And if a certain type of younger progressive can't look at the Democratic Party and tell themselves that they got something out of that that made it better, these are not people that are going to be voting for Republicans. They're just not going to be voting. And that's how Republicans win midterms. And that's what happened in 2010. And this is a scary midterm because, you know, the one thing that's different with 2010 and now, and maybe we can get into this a little bit, the playing field's different. Some of the Senate seats that are up for grabs aren't as bad. The slate's not as bad as it was in 2010. So there's some advantages here, I think, relative to 2010, where 2012 doesn't look quite as bad for Democrats, or 2022 doesn't look quite as bad for Democrats. But they're heading towards something really bad here. And I mean, what do you think, before we go to Kamala Harris, what do you think is... What does a realistic outcome of next year's midterms look like?
I think the Democrats lose control of the Senate and barely hang on to the House. They might even lose the House, though. But I mean, I think realistically, they come out of this and they have no houses of Congress left. And I've been very worried this whole time. I talked about it on the last episode. Not that I expect you to have heard this, but like, I'm worried that people aren't really recognizing that the Democrats really only have this 24-month window. And then after the control range is a very, very, very limited. And so like, when I'm getting angry at Biden and Harris for not acting, and like really raging at them, know that I'm doing this with a sense of urgency that I look at this time window as through 2028 and think that like maybe the next time the Democrats are gonna have a chance to do anything is gonna be in 2028. Maybe they have a nice little 4-year run off of that because the demography has finally changed. But this is the last slice in my 30s for us to do anything. Yeah. So I'm watching Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema sabotage my 30s. Maybe we'll get him in my 40s here. At this point. Yeah. So it's really frustrating. And like, yeah, I mean, it is sort of tailor-made to like make people want to stay home. I mean, a number of people who, you know, are listeners of the show have already, you know, they reluctantly voted for Democrats the last time around, knowing that Trump is very bad. Trump's not on the ballot next time around. So they might go, well, fuck the Dems. I'll worry about Trump if he's back on the ballot, maybe. But he's not on the ballot right now, so fuck him. I think that's going to be a really tempting impulse. And it's going to be easy because you can just not put on pants and stay home that day.
Exactly. I mean, I think we're going to see some weird youth turnout numbers that are just going to doom the party in 2022. I was looking, I was doing a little bit of count the numbers.
You know
here
what? Honestly, that
started.
Might actually be good. That might actually be like I hate to say it like this, but like if the Democrats got the results from 2022 and youth turnout cratered, was like way like 5% of you know, like, you know, normally when they turn out about 20% or something like that, like, and it's like 10% or 8%. If that would actually be a shot across the bow that the Democrats have been too old and too gerontocratic.
I would really like to see something like that happen. I mean, I'm sick of being in a world in which we have to let the disaster happen before people acknowledge that a disaster exists. We just can't prepare or plan for anything. I could have told you I did tell everyone like 6 years ago. I mean, and not like I have a unique side on this. It's just obviously what we're seeing. The party's getting younger. Their perspectives and preferences are changing. They're not being thrown a bone at all. And like, you are missing a long-term opportunity. You're going to have some people that you could have had for their entire lives that will just abandon the party at this point. So, I mean, that's what they're facing now in 2022. Now, because the map is not that bad for Democrats compared to some Senate maps, like 2024 is going to be a much more difficult Senate map, even though I think their odds to doing well are probably better in that election. 2022 is a fairly favorable Senate map in that I did a quick count of different seats. Basically, what we're looking at is 10 seats that really in any remote universe matter. Florida, Rubio running. I would consider all of the currently Republican held seats to maintain control on the Republican side. Rubio is probably going to keep his seat. He's got a pretty good challenger in Val Demings, but I think he'll keep his seat. North Carolina has a retirement. Burr retired. But I don't see North Carolina flipping blue in a midterm election year. Wisconsin, the big question is if
Ron Johnson's
if he's going to run again. If he doesn't, I think that could be a lot more interesting. The Ohio Senate race is fascinating just because of the depravity of the candidates on the Republican side. I mean, Josh Mandel and J.D. Vance are two of the worst candidates in the entire country in the history of running, and they're both running against each other. Ohio is normally a race I would just tell you to completely ignore, but they are choosing probably one of two candidates that are so awful, I actually think the Democrat could potentially have a chance.
Vance has a legit and same with Mandel. Both have a legitimate chance of actually like doing a Todd Akin legitimate rape sort of
right,
comment.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. This is like a Todd Akin kind of election to me. So Ohio, normally I wouldn't even include it on this list, but Mandel and Vance are making it competitive. On the Democratic side, I think, you know, you're going to see a lot of Democrats also keep their seats. The New Hampshire race, we just learned that Sununu is not going to run in that race, which makes it a lot more winnable for Democrats. They'll probably keep that seat. Michael Bennett, I just am totally signed on. Colorado's a blue state. I don't think that's a competitive state realistically anymore. So I think he'll win. Pennsylvania, I'm going to be paying a lot of attention to that race. One, because it's going to be close, although I would imagine I do think the Democrats will win that seat. I'm paying attention to it because I think, honestly, flat out, Fetterman is the best candidate that's run for any seat in the United States, probably other than maybe an AOC or something in like recent memory in the past like 2 or 3 years. Fetterman is a fantastic candidate, and I just hope that they give him everything that he needs to run that campaign and just keep pushing, because like that's who the Democrats should be centering their entire party around right now.
I mean they also had that Richard Ojeda guy, like AOC, Richard Ojeda, John Fetterman. I want strange white guys Strange, yes. White guys. Strange white. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They need to be oddballs because, like, these are our white guys. Like, they're white guys all, like, wear the t-shirts and wear the glasses and they drive the trucks and they have a very homogenous look about them. Our white guys look like us. Scruffy and weird looking. Weird artwork in the background. Too many cats.
Like, to this point, I mean, imagine Fetterman, like, literally airdrop him in. Don't even give him, like, oh, he used to be, you know, like 10 years of experience in Virginia. Just literally airdrop him in and run him for governor instead of McAuliffe. I think that Fetterman wins. I mean, he doesn't even have to have a connection to the area. Fetterman just wins because Virginia goes Republican because the working class people increasingly think the Democrats are not their party. They're wrong about that, but the Democrats aren't doing anything to convince them of that. And Terry McAuliffe is the last person on fucking planet Earth that is going to convince them that they should be voting blue.
So is Kamala Harris, who we wanted to talk about. This is the Kamala problem, right? Like, at the core of her, she is this patrician-y girl boss. Like, her entire image is like, yeah, slay queen, girl boss. Like, I am an insider. I am the girl boss. I'm a lady boss, but I work inside this. Like, and it's not something that the average working person relates with. When you say you're the boss, that's neat. I'm the worker. I'm not the boss of shit. I work for people. I actually really don't like people who take a strong sense of identity off of being a boss. Like I don't like being around those people. They aren't my pipe. So much of Kamala Harris's strength image is done in a way that it's like strength, but like a strength that you resent sort of thing.
It's a lean in kind of like become part of the system and that's how you empower yourself. That's like, I think that's like this crater as a messaging for the Democratic Party right now, because the thing with Harris is with that message, with like, you know, if we think of Harris, which I think is like mostly fair, is kind of this like yes queen bumper sticker right now. Like, you're gonna lose 45 and over because that's incomprehensible to them. It doesn't mean anything to them. They don't know what's going on. Like, they don't understand the entire movement. So you've just lost them. And now usually you can make up for that by plunging into the, you know, under 45 demographic. But like, I talk to my students, like,
she's your extra boss.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, she's the shitty person that you would have worked for as an intern on a campaign that would have made your life miserable. And like, the thing I talk to my students, like, I asked them the other day, one of the posts that they had to make for the class was, what do you think that politicians should do these days to talk effectively to your generation? And the number one response, I mean, to a person, I think everyone said this, was, don't do this like, hello, fellow kids. How do you do, fellow kids? Like, fake bullshit. They can spot a bumper sticker. Kamala Harris saying, yes, queen, is going to work on this exact specific type of person, like maybe in their 30s, but you've lost Generation Z. They can spot bullshit and sloganeering coming from a mile away. And I think that you're losing the old people, using the young people. She has like her very bad record as a prosecutor that's also going to hurt her with young people, people of color. So, I mean, the idea that we would try to build the movement to the next generation of Democrats around her is terrifying to me because it won't work. And if they try to force it, it super won't work.
The thing I'm worried about the most right now on the Democrat side is that they're going to be coy about Joe Biden not running again so that they can kind of clear the runway for Kamala Harris to try to take off and get that bird off the ground and basically face an uncontested primary. Now, don't get me wrong. I think it was a bit of a political masterstroke on her part to run a really bad campaign in 2020, realize it was running really badly, and then drop out and endorse Joe Biden when he absolutely needed it the most. The masterstroke of her life, and she achieved the vice presidency off of it. That's a pretty solid run as someone who's actually done a lot of research on vice presidents now. It's actually not a bad arc for a vice president. But she's absolutely not the face of the party. We sort of nailed it. Like, she's your extra boss. So, like, for older people, if you're like in their 50s or 60s and you're still in the workforce, working for Kamala Harris, the young, hot, extra boss who's overachieved you, doesn't necessarily have any sort of like vibe for you. And as a younger person, like, you know, Kamala going like, oh yeah, I like the Tupac records too, to me, you know, like, beyond the fact that her Tupac timeline doesn't like lay up or whatever, like that misses me. And like, yeah, I mean, this is my experience from working with kids, right? Like, How do I interact with children? I basically talk to them as real as I possibly can. Obviously, there's certain ways that I can't say this or that or whatever, but basically I try to be unrelentingly real with them. The Democrats are actually very bad at like focused market like phrases and stuff. Like their new thing is like Trump is dangerous for American families. Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, like that's the thing. So like, yeah, no, it's very easy to see through some of these like focused Democrat lines because they just like they lack any real resonance. I mean, I'm really hopeful that we have a primary in 2024, but then I also go like, okay, Sean, like this is a good last question. Like if someone's going to run against Harris, who would that even be at this point? Because I think AOC's not old enough to do it.
No, I don't think that she wants to create, like, that's not the right time to insert herself into this. AOC, I think, is exceptionally smart when it comes to campaigning and campaign messaging. She's hitting all the right notes. And I think she knows 2024 is this weird moment where it's going to be, if she runs, it's a double statement. It's an attack on Biden, and it's also a vote of no confidence for Harris, which I think will play weird in certain parts of the country amongst certain parts of the base. So I think she's smart enough. I don't think it would be an option for her because of the age thing. I think she's just under it. But I would if I were her, 28 is a good time to launch your first campaign. In 2024, though, in terms of, you know, who challenges it, I think Sanders? I mean, I don't know if there's really a movement challenge it.
No. He's 84. We gotta stop. I mean,
He shouldn't.
I mean, he's 92 now. Like, yeah, Sean, he's 96. He just turned 100.
Man, 30 years from now, we'll be running his corpse. I mean, like, there's no end to this, but it's the same problem of 2016 of how did you get Sanders in 2016? Because everyone within the party knew you don't go against the family, and the family is Hillary Clinton, and he's the only one that doesn't give enough of a shit. He's just going to do it anyway. Now, 2024, I see the same thing. There's going to be a Joe Biden contingent. Then there's going to be a Harris contingent that's like, and I don't think that there's enough oxygen in the room that the party's even going to allow for there to be that third person. So inevitably, when someone doesn't like the sort of moderate angle that that's taking or the mealy mouth nothingness of the party that those two candidates would represent, who do I see rising up again who doesn't give a shit? I see Sanders doing it. Maybe a Warren, but I see Sanders doing it. And like you said, he's not the voice that we need at this point. We need to pass on the baton to a different person.
And I don't think Warren is either. I think Warren's time was right now. We decided to give it to Joe Biden. Her time was maybe in 2016. We decided to give it to Joe Biden. That's done. I'm done with that. Sanders people need to be done with Sanders too. Because look, I like both of them, but both of them, I mean, here's the thing about Sanders. If Sanders was going to fight, now would be an exceptionally wonderful time to fight real hard. So like this whole narrative and the myth of Bernie the progressive fighter, I would believe it so much more if he had been performing more valiantly over the last 11 months here. But it really looks like Joe Manchin's had his number. Ditto with Warren. Warren has tried to play the inside game a little bit and has made a little bit of headway doing it that way, but like it's on the margins, and like there are some good administrators in because of her and that sort of thing. I'm like not going to poo-poo all of it, but at the same time, both Sanders and Warren have not done anywhere near enough. And like, I mean, this is the thing where I feel really empty with the Democratic Party right now. It's like, I look at Harris and she doesn't represent me. Joe Biden decidedly tells me all the time that people like me who smoke weed are bad people who need to go to rehab. So he's not my guy. Who do I vote for? Like, you know, like when do I get to vote for John Fetterman?
Yeah. I mean, that I was going to say the Fetterman 2024, a trial balloon campaign. I don't think he would do that. And I also think it would be a bad idea, but I mean, that's the kind of person, again, like you have to start floating new challenges to the leadership. There's certain people that I think can be really effective. Not doesn't have to be president of the United States, but the kind of person maybe do a little bit more to build some of the rhetoric around. I would just be happy if like we substituted out like a Biden kind of voice for even like a Cory Booker kind of voice, just someone that is younger that at least hits some of the notes.
That, I mean, even Hakeem Jeffries, who's like deeply square, that guy's Squaresville is all hell, but he'd be a major improvement from Pelosi just because he would look younger. At least it doesn't look like grandma and grandpa Democrat scold coming at, you know, like Pelosi, like seems so hopelessly out of touch. Schumer seems like these people don't even seem like real people. Like, you look at Chuck Schumer. I don't know anyone who looks like Chuck Schumer other than Chuck Schumer. You know, these aren't people I can relate with. And I think, like, I mean, a big thing that the Republicans are actually quite good at is they make their politicians almost painfully like them. Marjorie Taylor Greene is them. Matt Gaetz is them.
Trump is them. I mean, like, that was the big thing. He doesn't have this, like, 170 IQ social psychology degree. He gets their votes. He understands who they are because they're the same type of not really paying attention but feel owed something inherently by society, thin-skinned kind of people. He's performing the act of being them, and it works. And I don't think the Democrats, it's too careerist of a ladder. They don't even
prioritize trying to be like the Dem voters, though, which is the thing. I mean, like, insofar as they try to do that, they go like, you know, they'll appeal to demography groups, but they don't actually try to, like, be like liberals. Not really. And, like, even when they do it, it's like super awkward. Like the time they all wore kente cloth and, like, wore the mask and, like, made like the, you know, we're fighting hard, you know, like they're not. I mean, it's the big thing is, like, it's hard to vote for people who aren't like you. I mean, it's way easier to vote for someone who's like you, even if they're going to do a bad job. Like, you know, he kind of looks like me. I don't know. Maybe the shaggy guy who smokes too much pot would be good at governor. Probably not. But, like, it'd be much easier for me to get my brain around that, like McConaughey, because, you know, oh, okay. You kind of, that's not superficial, but, like, much easier to get your brain around that than it is to look at someone completely different from you and vote for them.
I mean, I think to what you're saying, like to put a bow on all this and maybe close things out, like the word of the day on this show is trust, and it's social trust. And that's, like, what we lack. That's what the Democratic Party is not producing. That's definitely what we lack as a society, as a democracy right now. We want people who seem like they understand our day-to-day concerns to be in office. They are not. One party is doing a good job of pretending to be them. The other party's not even trying. And there's just so many things. Like, this does not have to be this close. We've ran 50-50 between the two parties for a really long time. There's been like 8 opportunities for the Democrats to pull away, and they're still just letting them hang around in the game.
But both of those are the assault on trust. One, you have the fakers, like a Ron DeSantis, who is, like, Ivy League educated and now pretends to be, like, a dumb guy who, like, can barely read a book or put on a mask, right? Or you have the Democrats, who basically kind of, like, stiff arm you on a regular basis, and so you don't trust them. They say, we're going to give you $2,000. They give you $1,400. You know, Joe Biden said that he wanted to do a $15 minimum wage. I mean, like, they say lots of things, or worse still, they don't even say stuff, and that makes you not trust them either. Frieder, we got to do this again sometime, sooner rather than later. Although I actually suspect, I can't talk about it too much right now in the air, but I suspect that if I had to make a prediction, 2022 is going to be a much more robust, don't worry about the government year, because I'm going to have more stuff going on. But we should try to get you on after school gets out. When does school get out for you?
Man, come back on at the mid-end of December, early January, something like that. That sounds good to me. You can talk 2022 and how depressing that year is going to be.
Yeah, looking forward to it. But it's always fun to chat with you, my dude. So, same. Sean Frieder, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find my work going to seanfrieder.com. You can see some of my academic work there if you're interested. Always taking friends on Facebook if you're interested in seeing what I'm posting on there occasionally. Otherwise, got questions about politics, hit me up, email me, go to my website. Happy to chat with you.
As for this show, you can find us on Twitter at DWHEG. I am never taking friends on Facebook, so don't even try. Patreon.com/DWHEG is the Don't Worry Patreon homepage. Got a number of nice messages after the last episode. Guys, show's not going anywhere. Show's not, everyone rest concerned. Recharging, making music and stuff, but working on career stuff. Show's still here. Show's alive and well. But I appreciate all the well wishes over at patreon.com. The new song that I put out in the last episode's up there. I think I'm probably gonna, like, launch a little, like, thing where I explain, like, how I do the different background music and, like what goes into writing that. So if you're interested in that, I'm gonna probably soft test pilot that here in the next week or two. I'd love some feedback, so go and check that out at patreon.com/DWATG. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Spotify. Thank you all so much for listening. I appreciate your patronage. I appreciate your listenership. I appreciate Sean Frieder for coming on. And until the next one,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.